All right, so I think we can all agree now that one of the big attractions to electron microscopy right now is because of this resolution regime that we can now reach. Everything seems to be going to better than 5 angstroms for most well-behaved single particle analyses and macromolecules. And so for this, at least this wedge right here of the resolution pi is particularly interesting to me for single particle analyses, because most reconstructions that come from this resolution range are minimal to atomic modeling, which allows for really good structure function studies and oftentimes allows for structure-based drug design and the idea of these really nice therapeutics that could aid in disease states. And so I think we can all agree that once we get to this resolution regime, we really try to eke out all of the information we can from both our electron microscope, as what Anchi was talking about, as well as just our data, which is some of the things we heard from the different processing pipelines from our different developers. And so case in point, if you take beta-galactosidase, a little small region here where you have an alpha helix and this loop that I've generated at around 4.95 angstroms or so, as you start to increase in about half angstrom resolution increments, what you start to see is around 4.5 or so, the really bulky side chain density starts to become apparent. Once you get beyond 4, you start to see most side chains for the alpha helix. This loop now becomes discernible versus just a big bolus of density. And then as you get beyond 3, almost all your side chains are resolved and you get really nice backbone density once you get really close to 2, which is something that we all really want to strive for. And so what we do is, if you look at the EM data bank and you actually look at all the structures that come out at, that have been resolved to better than 5 angstroms resolution, you see a really large disparity. One thing that you see is almost all the structures, greater than 98% of these structures, have been determined at 300 keV. And more importantly, if you look, over 90% have been solved on this one beast, the FEI Thermo Fisher Titan Krios. And so this raises one of the most obvious questions, is why is the Titan Krios currently our go-to instrument for high-resolution single-particle analyses? And so I think one of the most obvious reasons is because it has 3 constant power condenser lens series. And so that has really stable optics. The third condenser lens series, the third condenser lens in particular, confers a wide range of beam intensities that allow for parallel illumination, which is really important for high resolution studies. It's highly customizable, like what Anchi was talking about. You can mix and match in different permutations of energy filters, CS correctors, different cameras, different stages in that matter, that can really give you a customized scope for what you want to do. And I think that it needs to also be mentioned that this was actually one of the first microscopes, if not the first microscope, with an autoloader. So there are limitations with stage movements by having a side entry holder, which people are well aware of, but by having an autoloader, it allows for a really stable stage, really nice scope that are stable, and then you also have a lot of the ability to rapidly screen through samples and figure out which specimen is going to work for your high resolution studies. And so the next question that was proposed for me to talk about this workshop is access to a Krios necessary to compete in the high-resolution cryo field? Hopefully, at the end of my talk, you'll realize, no, you don't actually need that. You can have, quote-unquote, lower-end instrumentation. Several people in the audience have been using TF20s or other two-condenser lens series to show that you don't need that. But I think this talk will be a little bit more emphatic. Can conventional cryo-EM be used to solve small structures? So can you use traditional under-focus methodologies, i.e. no faceplate, to actually solve really small things, less than 200 kilodaltons? And yes, you can. And so, like most people at Scripps, we have a Titan Krios with a K2, and it's typically booked 2, 3, 4 months in advance. And so a lot of times you're trying to get your optimal specimen, you have grids, they send your doer for 2 or 3 months, and you're just begging to get on the Krios. And so we talked to FEI at the time, and they told us, well, we have this new instrument, it's called the Talos Arctica. It's a 2 condenser lens series with an autoloader. You can put a K2 on it, and it should be a really good, quote-unquote, screening scope. So you can put your grids in there, you can collect overnight, and you can get a decent reconstruction, and you'll know which grids to put into your Krios. And so what we did is we ordered one, no faceplate, no energy filter, and we put a K2 camera on there that we had previously had on a TF20. And we decided to start using this thing and figure out what it could do. And one of the first specimens that we put in there was a trip channel. And after about a day and a half, 2 days of data collection, we had a 3.2, 3.3 angstrom trip channel off of 24 hours of data collection. And so at this point, we realized that, you know, this looks really, really good. Do we really need to go into a Krios after this data collection? And second of all, how high can this thing actually go? What are the current limitations of this instrument, a two condenser lens series with an autoloader K2 operating at 200 kV? And so that's what we set out to do. I don't have a lot of time for my talk, so I'm not going to go through all the technical details, but some things that I really want to mention. One, all my grids were manually frozen, either me or my rotation student, Mingyu Wu. Very much like Jacques Dubochet was doing back, you know, 30 years ago. We're in the cold room manually blotting. So even though tons of developments are going into the VentureBot and spotted on, super exciting stuff, you can also do this and with our quote-unquote archaic technology. We use Legend on Appion exclusively. Great resources if you don't have them at your facility. We use Motion Core 2, developed at UCSF. We use CTF54 from Alexi and Nico, with also per particle local CTF estimations from GCTF. And then we used various different iterations of Relion to solve our reconstructions. The other thing that I should mention is that for all the data sets I'm going to show, we use stage position to navigate to each of our exposure targets. And so we do have a settling time, and we don't introduce an image shift into our data. If you're really interested in the methodologies, you can come talk to me after the talk, or if you can, please go. The bioarchive paper has been up for many months, and I'm sure a lot of you have already read it. The abridged version is now in Nature Methods, and then we also have a protocol exchange in Nature Protocols detailing some of the alignments that we did, at least for this paper. So if you're interested, please take a look. All right, so like most people in the field, when you have a new instrument, you, like Lanchi said, you want to test specimens. So we did exactly what most people do, and we sent a very nice, flattering email to Yifan and his group asking for the archaeal T20S proteasome. And he very kindly sent it with one of his postdocs. And very quickly, doing some optimizations on the scope, imaging conditions, we were able to get a 3.1 angstrom structure of the 20S proteasome off of our microscope. And what's really nice, and for the very first time, as far as I can tell, off a 200 keV scope with a 2-condenser lens series, you can see very nicely ordered water molecules. These are also in the similar positions that Melody and David saw from their Creo structure of the T20S, as well as in the crystallographic structures that were deposited in the PDB. What's also really nice is at this resolution, you can actually see two alternative rhodomeric conformations for side chains. And these positions actually align really well with the ideal torsion angles that are estimated from EM Ringer, the package that's coming out of UCSF. So this was really exciting. This hadn't been seen before, and we were really excited to move forward with this. And looking at what our density we were able to get out from the proteasome, comparing it to Melody and David's previously published Creo structure, at least qualitatively, the density looks really, really comparable. You can do cross-correlations, you can look at things by FSC, but at least qualitatively, if I swap this slide around 10 times and change the colors, you couldn't tell what density was what. And so this is actually really, really exciting because the Arctica is actually much cheaper than the Creos. Great, so we were super excited, and we started telling people that we had the T20S at 3.1 angstroms off in Arctica, and then of course people were like, okay, yeah, cool, this is the 20S, what else can you really do? And so we decided to see if we can actually go to less than 200 kilodaltons. And so I sat there and I went through the Sigma catalog and I went to the protein data bank and I figured out what was less than 200 kilodaltons, what could I actually purchase that was of decent purity, and what had been previously crystallized to high resolution. And after about 3 or 4 days of searching, I actually found something that looked really amenable. So rabbit muscle autolase, you've probably heard of it. It's in the glycolytic pathway. It's about 152 kilodalton. It's a homotetramer D2 symmetry, and it behaves really nicely, at least by, you know, gel filtration. So we basically bought it, lyophilized, solubilized it, put over gel filtration, and immediately froze grids. So we've seen a lot of 20S images, so this serves as a good reference point. This is the particle density we strive for the previous data set. This is at 45,000x with about 0.91 angstrom per pixel in super resolution mode. This is a 700 kilodalton enzyme. No, it's a 700 kilodalton protein, I should say. Autolase is 152 kilodalton, and you can see the size disparity between the two particles in these micrographs. Now, as you've heard from other talks at this workshop, Autolace is somewhat unique in as it can pack in this really nice, tight, shoulder-to-shoulder particle density configuration of the micrographs. You can actually draw lines between the particles, which is really nice. It's hard to see here because of the interpolation of the projector, but nonetheless, we can actually isolate individual particles and we can get really nice 2D class averages using traditional methodologies. So using Relion and the different software packages, pretty quickly we were able to get a 2.6 angstrom resolution reconstruction of rabbit muscle autolace off of our Arctica. And you can see most of the core is actually estimated to around 2.5. Some regions are resolved to around 2.8 or so, and most of the entire molecule is resolved to better than 3. You can look at secondary structure elements, and in fact, we have most of the side chains are really well resolved. Backbone density looks really nice. And as you would expect for something at this resolution, you can clearly see nice ordered water molecules. As Yifan was mentioning, they are apparent in both half maps, so this isn't just random noise. And also, these water molecules align well with what all the previous crystal structures have portrayed. So this was really nice. We were super excited. Again, people were asking us, okay, you're at 150, you're at 2.6. You don't seem to be limited that much. Can you go smaller? So went back to Sigma and found something that was less than 100 kilodalton, alcohol dehydrogenase from equine. It's an 82 kilodalton enzyme. It is a homodimer with C2 symmetry. It's been previously determined by X-ray methodologies to really high resolution. And so we bought it, immediately put over gel filtration, and then realized that when we purchased it, it says purity is based on specific activity. This isn't based on gel purity. And so as you can see, look at the bands across our gel filtration curve, it is quite a hot mess. But after a couple of weeks of purifications, we were able to get really nice, really pure alcohol dehydrogenase just using a few different columns. We froze grids. Again, knowing what we knew about autolace, we really packed the particles in there. It's hard to see on these images, but what you can see is this is what we call the side view, and this is the end-on view. They have very disparate particle dimensions, but nonetheless, if you look closely, you can see nice individual particles in different views. If you actually run 2D classification within Relion, you can see we get nice different end-on views right here, side views, tilt views, and the actual class averages look really, really nice for an 80 kilodalton protein. Secondary structure elements are readily apparent within the 2D class averages, and as you would expect based on that, if you do a reconstruction within Relion, you get a 2.9 angstrom structure of an 81 kilodalton protein without a phase plate. Most of the molecule is resolved to much better than 3 angstroms resolution. And what's really nice and what we were super excited about is if you actually zoom into the active site, this is an NADH utilizing enzyme. So it has a bound NADH cofactor. And if you look at the density is quite remarkable. And this is really exciting because you've heard from some of these pharma companies that they want to look for high resolution targets to do drug discovery or structure-based drug design. Based on what we have shown here, this is actually somewhat feasible. So when we put statements like that in our grants, we can actually do this really well now. Okay, so we're at 81 kilodaltons, but of course everyone's heard of what Rado's done because of his amazing work with his group in human hemoglobin. So everyone's probably seen his paper by now. Everyone's heard about how great the faceplate is. And looking at this, we were interested, is this the limit of what we could possibly do? Is 80 kilodaltons the best of what we could do using traditional under-focused methodologies, or could we do something a little bit better? And so we've tried quite a bit over the past few months, and these are the best grids we can currently get right now. Human hemoglobin does not like gold grids, unfortunately. Gold grids, as what you've heard from Chris and Lori Passmore over the years, are really nice, stable grid supports. Unfortunately, hemoglobin sticks to it like crazy, and we cannot get great particle density within the holes, unfortunately. But nonetheless, if you take the class averages from 2D reference-free classification that Rado published in his paper and compare it to what we're getting using traditional under-focused methodologies, the class averages look quite nice. You can see secondary structure elements. If you compare orthogonal views between the two data sets, it looks really nice. And as much as I want to keep going with the train of higher and higher resolution, we're dead. We're stuck at about 4.5 angstroms right now. And we don't really know why. We're worried that it may be something to do with the noise estimates. We're worried it may be doing something with mixing of the alpha and beta protomers. We're not really sure. It may also just be strictly limited by particle number. Hopefully, in beginning of the year, you'll have an update from us and we'll have this fixed. But nonetheless, this is quite exciting because I think when I started my postdoc 3 years ago, no one thought this was really feasible until Rado showed that you could go really small using phase plates, and now we're showing that you need to rethink what you actually can do using traditional methodologies. And so what do we think was important? We don't really know 100%, but we have an idea of what we thought was really important. One is careful column alignments. We were really careful in maximizing parallel illumination for the two condenser lens series, and we stayed there during the entire data collection. So we were very careful about these alignments. As you've seen from Alex Noble, who presented earlier in the week, and some of the other people at the NYSBC NRAM group, Autolase is unique that it packs in a really tight single layer of particles and super, super thin ice. And we think this was really critical to actually allowing us to get really nice particle contrast, to get the good imaging conditions and get a good reconstruction. You also heard from Paul Mooney that if you calculate a DQE curve using a 200 kV versus 300 kV instrument on their K2, you actually get a nice boost in the low spectral frequencies beyond half Nyquist, which is where we were operating. We were actually operating right here for most of our data sets. And so we actually had better imaging conditions on our camera, and we also very carefully set the exposure rate on our camera to be within a regime to where we weren't having a lot of coincidence loss. And so the other thing that we have to talk about is, of course, specimen stability. These are not your run-of-the-mill heterogeneous floppy proteins. We had gold grids, which is a very nice stable support system. We use proteins that are they like to crystallize. They behave very well, stable specimens. And also, we had a really nice stage within the Arctica. Also, there's supposed to be a logo right here that says Legend on an Appion. So without having the ability to rapidly go from data acquisition to statistics within the Appion database, we could not have been able to find the thin ice as quickly as we were able to. We spent probably 3 or 4 hours aligning the scope, and we spent probably 6 or 7 hours trying to find the right grids and right squares to actually image. So a lot of time was actually spent trying to find the right areas to image. Real quickly, what could we do better? What are the anticipated limitations? We're not really sure what we could do better, but we have an idea. One thing we're really curious about is how far can we go away from parallel illumination before it really affects our imaging conditions. We're not really sure at the moment, but we have an idea. If you're really far, it's going to be kind of a hot mess. Per frame, per particle CTF correction, this was alluded to a little bit earlier in the meeting. We think that this might be able to help a lot of data sets get closer to the 2 angstrom range. I didn't go into this much at all, but alternative processing strategies. A lot of questions we get is why did the 20S die at 3.1 angstroms versus these smaller molecules are getting to higher resolutions beyond 3? We don't really know, but it may be doing something with how we're actually classifying and refining our data. And the other thing is the lower to focus range. I didn't mention this because of time, but so far for most of our data sets, nothing imaged beyond 1.5 microns under focus contribute at all to our high resolution information. And then, of course, what are the anticipated limitations? This is not going to work for every specimen. Particle heterogeneity can be a really big problem, especially as you become smaller and smaller because of the actual contrast of the particles. Not all particles can tolerate thin ice and a really high particle density, like what we saw with autolase and alcohol dehydrogenase. And not all particles actually tolerate getting into super, super thin ice. Some will denature at the air-water interface, is what we've heard from many people at this workshop. So there are current limitations. And the other thing I have to mention is you're slightly inflexible when choosing your exposure rate. For a given magnification and for a given spot size, you're going to have a certain parallel illumination condition, which is going to confer you only a certain exposure rate on your camera, and you have to choose those very carefully in your imaging conditions. So, acknowledgments. I really have to thank Gabe and an amazing grad student, Mingyu Wu. We were very much a team in every aspect of this, between freezing grids, data collection. Mingyu was with me almost every aspect of this entire project. I also want to thank Lander Lab for their contributions, Mr. Bill Anderson, our facility manager, for keeping a bunch of microscopes up and running. He does an amazing job. JC Ducom and Lisa Dong at the Scripps High Performance Computing Facility for keeping allowing us to process as much data as we do. Charles Bowman, who's also in the facility, keeps things running for the microscopes as far as connectivity and technical aspects. Batim Vose for his conversations about parallel illumination. Paul Mooney-Gatan for conversations about the actual imaging conditions for the camera. Shores for his help during processing. Yifan and his postdoc, Zan Lin, for the donation of 20S. Funding for Gabe. Helen Hay Whitney Foundation for my funding. And then if you don't already do so, please deposit within BioArchive. It gives us an ability to actually put things online much quicker, which is why y'all heard about Aldolase much earlier than what it could have been. And also it takes away some of the power from these big journals. And then also, if you haven't had time, go ahead and read this paper about multimodal validation. And thank you.
Thanks, Mark. So we'll take a few questions. And but David, before you come down, I think we might take a break. We'll take a short break, and then we'll return at...
Really?
Clint was suggesting it. We could vote on it.
They take a short break after these questions, and then come back for the last two, rather than...
Okay.
What do people think?
What does the audience think? Who's in favor of a break now?
Okay.
Who's in favor of a break after this? All right, break now.
Okay, a few questions.
Questions, yeah. Questions?
Hello?
Yep. Yeah.
How low a defocus could you go with your small particles?
So we set the random defocus range in Legendon from 600 nanometers to 1.6 microns. And in the final particle stacks, we have things ranging from 400 nanometers to about, 1.8 microns.
And on the low range, which images did you keep?
Like, so
did you keep the one that at 0.4?
Yeah. So the only selection that we did as far as CTF is we only selected based on confidence value of the fit. We didn't actually do a hard selection on resolution. So they're...
So I noticed, I guess, a couple of things. I think in one of your first slides, there's this seeming anti-correlation between the size of the particle and the resolution that you get. Can you comment on that? And after that, I'll ask another question.
That's fine. We don't know for sure. But one of the things that we're worried about is if you're not at perfectly parallel illumination, then as you introduce a defocus, you may have slight changes in magnification of the particles under those different imaging conditions. And as you're averaging those slightly different sized particles, you're not going to be able to reach higher resolution. And because the particles are larger, you have more voxels to average over, which is going to give you more problems as you work on viruses with the 20S. But again, we haven't tested this, so we don't really know.
You talked about this a little bit. The 1.5 micron kind of limit, I guess, how do you establish that? And can you talk about it a little bit more?
Yeah, so that's when we first started doing classifications for the data sets, we noticed that if we had a slightly smaller box size, or depending on the values that we use for classification, all the high defocused particles would wind up in one class. And so what we did then is, if you look at the final particle stack, even though the range of defocus in that particle stack is up into 2 microns, there's actually only 70 particles in that stack beyond 1.5 micron. And if you eliminate those and redo the reconstruction, you get the exact same resolution.
Yeah. Amazing work. I think we may not need face plates soon. So for the hemoglobin, I definitely think you are limited by particle numbers, because looking at the 2D classes, they look even better than ours, I think. I think a very interesting test, even though maybe a bit expensive, would be to compare 300 and 200 kV on a Krios, using one of your amazing optimized samples. That would be very interesting comparison to actually see, how much and in what case advantage the 300 kV provides. That would be very, I think, interesting.
Yeah, one of the things that we've thrown about in the facility would be to do 300 kV and 200 kV with the third condenser lens on, and then do both without the third condenser lens, and see how they behave.
I don't think you would. If you have parallel illumination with third or without third, it's still parallel, so I don't think that would be.
Hopefully. It depends on how carefully we can align it, right?
One question here. So I noticed that you use different pixel size for different size of protein. Is there any logic behind this? How do you choose the right pixel size?
So, correct. Yeah, I didn't mention that, but I had it up there. So looking at the micrographs for aldolase, we noticed that, you know, there's not many pixels that we're averaging over the particles. And so we were concerned that going to even smaller, we may need more pixels for the particles to actually make it work. And so before we collected the alcohol dehydrogenase with the higher mag, we also did that for aldolase as a proof of principle. And so we just went with those imaging conditions, assuming that that higher mag would help with our particles. But we haven't actually imaged alcohol dehydrogenase, the 80 kilodalton protein, at the lower mag. So,
hi, can I ask?
Yeah.
Have you discarded any frame during your?
Nope.
No.
We use motion cores dose weighting.
Okay.
Yep. And we actually, I was surprised that some people were playing with that parameter as much as they were, but we haven't done that yet. We haven't adjusted the actual total cumulative exposure to see how it weights things differently. We're doing that now. That's something that I started after the second day of the workshop. So we'll see what happens.
Okay.
I have one quick question. So what do you think the impact is on the environmental conditions? I know where your Artica is situated, it's a really nice room. If this was put maybe in a standard microscope room, or even some of the rooms that the cryoses have thermal shielding, acoustical shielding, things like that. Do you think there'd be impact? And that's a hard question to answer.
Yeah, I don't know. It's entirely possible. I mean,
just do it again with the door open.
Yeah, right? Or have someone just constantly coming in and out, right? Yeah. We don't know. We could speculate. It may affect things as far as, you know, certain imaging conditions, but I don't think it's going to be the difference between, you know, 3 and 5, I would say. But I have no idea.
Okay, let's thank Mark. It was a great talk. So we'll take a break, be back at 10:30.
Or maybe a little earlier.
A little earlier.
Thank you.